This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
A first-of-its-kind research study has analyzed the conflict of interest policies at the 17 medical schools across Canada. Maclean's magazine reports that, overall, the researchers found policies were permissive, meaning most medical schools allowed interactions with pharmaceutical sales reps and turned a blind eye to faculty relationships with speakers' bureaus, so instructors who teach students may also have speaking contracts with drug companies. Med schools failed to educate medical students about conflicts of interest despite the minefield they'd be entering. The research also found that protocols surrounding drug samples, which are known to influence physicians, prescribing practices, sometimes for the worse, were practically non-existent.
I spoke earlier this week with a specialist in medical ethics. Dr. Lynette Reed, PhD, is an associate professor of medicine and bioethics at Dalhousie University and is affiliated with that university's Department of Bioethics. Lynette wasn't involved in the specific study we're talking about today, but she's been observing and studying ethics in medicine for a considerable period of time. I began by asking Dr. Reed if she was surprised by the results of this study.
Yeah, the study really demonstrated that the conflict of interest policies at Canadian medical schools are relatively weak, that many topics are not covered at all in many schools, and that enforcement mechanisms may be unclear, or policies that exist may be quite permissive. You know, like most Canadians, 10 years ago, if I had seen this study, I would have been surprised. I suppose it's an assumption we often have as Canadians that when we hear of excesses of commercial promotion activities, we think, well, that sort of thing doesn't happen here. Surely that's a feature of American private medicine and not something you would see in Canada. But I've worked within ethics in the medical school context for a number of years now, and I've come to appreciate that the relationships really are fairly close and complex and very difficult to get a handle on from a regulatory perspective. From that perspective, I'm not surprised. I'm also not surprised from the perspective of having seen my own school go through its first round of policy formation around this. The Canadian schools were really following the lead of the American schools, the American Association of Medical Colleges, in starting to define policies in the last 5 years. And that's been a big step just to define any kind of policy specific to the medical school context at all.
Now, the study speaks broadly about conflicts of interest between those involved in medical education and industry, big pharmaceutical companies, and devices. Give us a sense of how these conflicts of interest might develop.
So you can kind of answer that question at a few different levels. So in specific, it's very multifaceted. In any specific case, it can be a matter of the faculty at a medical school being leaders in their field, being very attractive as speakers, as presenters, being invited by industry to present on their behalf and to present at information sessions, shall we call them, that are funded by industry and where the materials are provided by industry for the teaching purposes. That's called a speakers bureau system. So that's one area where they arise. There's, of course, relationships in terms of research participation, research grants, research design, research recruitment. In that area, there may be some scope for ethical arm's length funding of research studies by industry. But there is also a lot of gray areas and a lot of out-and-out dubious practices that are possible. I think once you have people who are very involved collaborating with industry in presenting what are called educational sessions, we might call them advertising or information sessions, but they would generally be understood by participants as educational sessions. I don't think those people necessarily would think twice about using the same materials, their slides, and their other teaching venues with residents, with postgraduate medical students, with undergraduate medical students. So you can see that there's a lot of different ways. There's even clinical routes. So there are clinics where industry is a partner, where industry might be funding a nurse at the clinic, and that might be a teaching site. That might be somewhere where students would circulate through many physicians' offices where physicians are getting lunch from a drug rep. Lunch is being delivered on a regular basis, where drug reps are part of how that clinic stays on top of the ever-evolving landscape of products available for treatment of medical concerns. That's just a sample. We could probably continue to multiply examples. But I suppose underneath it all, you've got basically that medicine is operating largely as a publicly funded healthcare system in Canada, physicians dedicated to the good patients as their primary ethical responsibility. And that's running up cheek and jowl with what is, by objective measures, the most profitable industry on the planet. That's the big picture answer to the question of how do these things arise.
The researchers in this study write, and I'm quoting, that the education of medical students should be based on the best clinical information available, unbiased by the pharmaceutical or other health products. Do these potential biases or these actual biases pose a threat to the health and well-being of Canadians?
It's very difficult to draw a direct line from something that happens in a classroom to many, many years later when people are in practice. But there are some good studies. There's a recent one in the United States. There's an earlier one in Canada that show that schools that do have more restrictive policies do produce physicians who are more rational prescribers, who are better prescribers, who prescribe for the right indications, prescribe the right doses, and look for other options than prescription drugs where appropriate. So there is evidence that medical school policies can have an influence down the line. I mean, in the context we're in Canada now, a recent paper by a graduate from the University of Toronto Medical School pointed out that the pain curriculum promoting the use of opioids for chronic pain management in the community that was delivered to undergraduate students at the University of Toronto was, in fact, consisting of curriculum materials developed by the industry that sold those products and included textbook that was funded by industry and included lecturers who were members of these speakers, we like to call them, on behalf of those same companies. That gets pretty close to directly being able to trace influence in medical education of physician-industry relations straight to what has become really one of the major prescribing scandals of our time, which is that deaths from physician-prescribed opioids have overtaken deaths from illegal drugs in Canada and the United States. I think we're past an era where we can say that the biases are, that there are all sorts of biases, everyone's biased, and drugs on the whole do more good than harm. So those are some of the kinds of rationalizations you hear for these close relationships. But I think the opioid prescribing has been a real wake-up call, should continue to be a wake-up call. And I think you could dig and find stories about off-label prescribing of antipsychotics for the indications that they haven't been approved for. I think that's probably the next thing we'll read about once opioids prescribing scandal has been taken care of.
Now, the research we've been discussing is focused on medical schools. What kind of research do we have about practicing physicians and their potential industry biases?
There's been enough studies that there's been a recent meta-analysis of the effect of industry relations on actual biases in prescribing, on prescribing quality. And that really finds, again, everything's complex. You were talking about complex interventions, so that study, which involves some of the same authors as this recent paper that we're talking about today, that meta-analysis, you call it, that summary of existing studies, found that the effects of industry relations with prescribing physicians was neutral to detrimental by and large. What we don't know in the Canadian context is real prevalence information, but there's an American study which found that 94% of the physicians that they surveyed, and that was across a range of six specialties, they found 94% of physicians had some sort of relationship with industry that involved an exchange of goods or, not an exchange, shall we say, but gifts of goods, gifts or goods or actual work in the form of consulting or acting as a speaker in speakers' bureaus. That included 83% of physicians receiving food regularly in their practices from drug reps, 78% receiving drug samples. So those are very high numbers. We don't have any particular reason to think those numbers are lower in Canada, although we don't have direct data on it. And when people say, well, everything's changed, that's almost 10 years ago, I think that it's not obvious that everything has changed. It has changed. The pens and mugs have changed. drug companies give out far fewer trinkets and device companies give out far fewer trinkets at conferences. That's a totally changed environment. The exhibit hall of the conference is no longer a gift giveaway site. But it hasn't really changed that people bring food with them, where they bring information to submission offices. And these substantial, significant relationships in terms of speakers, bureaus, and research participation and sponsorship, those things haven't been touched by these recent changes in pens and mugs. I did some research together with Matthew Herder at our school here at Dalhousie. We set about with a very modest goal. We just wanted to disprove the idea that this doesn't happen in Canada. So instead of completely reproducing the Campbell Survey of American Physicians, we just took one of the specialties they were talking about, cardiology, and we just looked at the top 5 publishing cardiologists at the medical schools across the country that had cardiology institutes. We established that industry relations tended to be specifically looking at speakers bureau and honoraria, that at most schools, 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 of the top 5 publishing cardiologists did have those kinds of relationships with industry. We feel them confidence to say we've shown that the idea that these relationships don't go on in Canada at all. We can't really say that we know that the prevalence is as high or higher or lower than what Campbell found in the United States, when he found 94% of physicians having active relationships with industry.
Is there a consensus about what may need to happen to prevent or to decrease conflicts of interest between medicine and industry?
There is no one pathway, and there's no clear consensus. I think it's multifaceted, and faculties of medicine can play a strong role because many leaders in the medical profession, of course, have appointments with faculties of medicine. The extent to which faculties of medicine are able to enforce those policies is another question. Their faculty tend to 20% of their life to the medical school, 80% of their life to the hospital, that kind of thing. So it's very difficult for the faculty of medicine to make strong demands on faculty, and I think that's one of the background factors you would see in the weakness of the policies that Schneier's group reviewed. Matthew Herder and I, in our paper, we argued that the provincial regulatory colleges actually should have a role. For example, they have very clear policies against physicians engaging in marketing of drugs. And we asked, in the paper that we published, we asked, why do they not think that physicians marketing drugs to other physicians should also be something they should look at from a disciplinary and regulatory perspective? The regulation, self-regulation process sometimes isn't very good at catching what is really a lucrative activity for physicians. Physicians are likely to be very reluctant to report their fellow physicians, even if the regulatory colleges were to clarify what we believe is already there in the CMA Code of Ethics, that promoting or working, being on the payroll of industry to promote drugs is inappropriate. What we don't have in Canada is a lot of public awareness and a lot of mechanisms in terms of the federal government or provincial governments looking at it. So in the United States, Senator Charles Grassley has been very, very active in bringing attention to these issues. You see them reported regularly, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, as part of the new healthcare reform in the United States. There's actually going to be a transparent and open database. Anybody who's selling, any company that's selling to Medicare basically or selling to the public insurers, is going to have to reveal the money that they're paying to doctors, and that goes to the public database. So that provides a kind of level of transparency about it, which we have no mechanisms for that in Canada. We have no access to that information. We have nowhere we can go and look up and see, you know, what kind of financial benefit does our own physician derive from relationships with industry. There's debate about whether disclosure is the best route. Some people might say, well, I'd just rather that it stops rather than my physician tell me that he or she is taking money from industry. I'd rather that it just stop. But at least that would be a step in visibility in Canada that would be useful to the public discussion. There's really sort of a lot of gray areas in terms of where people can have effective regulatory oversight here and where there's the political will to do it. So that leaves us in Canada with not a very clear way forward. The big pieces of the puzzle is that the profession itself and the academic medical centers need to develop better routes to keeping physicians up to date with good evidence-based information in practice from an academic perspective and not from the marketing perspective of the company.
Dr. Lynette Reed, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you.
Lynette Reed is an assistant professor in the Department of Bioethics at Dalhousie University. Dr. Reed is the coordinator for ethics education for undergraduate and postgraduate medical students at Dalhousie University.
And Ashta, I'd just like to add that there are a number of research studies out there on the internet, posted on the internet, that is, that focus on ethics in medicine, but there are also several news items that people, that listeners might find interesting. For example, the CBC reported on June the 10th, 2013, that Dr. Nav Persaud exposed inaccurate and potentially dangerous information about prescription opioid medications in medical school lecture series and books. Now, that information was shared with medical, dentistry, pharmacy, and other healthcare students at an industry-sponsored lecture series where participants were offered a free reference book on pain management. Now, Dr. Nav Persaud subsequently wrote a paper about that, and he called it questionable content of an industry-sponsored medical school lecture series, a case study. You can find that story and others like it simply by searching online.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.